time now, though, for politics. Neil Jones was Chief of Staff to Labour leader Jacinda Ardern, and prior to that was Chief of Staff to Andrew Little. He is Director of Capital Government Relations. Liam Hare is a Palmerston North lawyer, political commentator and a National Party member. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
G'day.
Cabinet decision today on alert levels expected this afternoon. What do you each predict? Liam, I'll start with you.
Oh, I think, you know, the status quo in Auckland, at least for a couple of weeks, I really can't see them trying to do anything too fancy in terms of dividing Auckland up into different Auckland zones or anything like that. Just too hard to do. But Auckland's not quite out of the woods yet, so I'd be surprised if they don't play for a bit more time with the current settings.
Neil?
Yeah, look, I tend to agree. I think it's worth taking stock. I mean, we're 4 weeks into the most dangerous strain of COVID we've seen. Almost no one else in the world is managing to get on top of it. But we are now just talking about 20 cases in one city, and all the indicators are in the right direction. There's just a few, you know, straggling cases, mystery ones, people getting infected in the community. And I think given that, no matter how low the cases are, the government will want to keep a ring around Auckland. And I think they'd be foolish to open up too soon. It only takes one case to get out of Auckland, or one case to escape the net, and we're back to square one.
Yeah, and I was so just going to say, the government locked down the country for less than this, right? And so, you know, it will have every incentive to finish the job.
Yep. And I think the rest of New Zealand will probably stay at level two as well, because given the thousands of people crossing the border and the odd case that escaped, like the couple who went to Wanaka for a holiday, I think we don't want to be in a situation where the rest of the country is at level one, one case gets out, and we're back to square one.
Yeah, as I mentioned, we were talking to a modeller, Michael Plank, first thing this morning, and you get that sense. I mean, we're hearing clips, you know, frustrated clips and seeing them on television from leaders in the South Island going, for heaven's sake, it's been over a year since we had a case here, and this is crippling our economy, and the ski fields still have snow on them. You know, we can still make the most of this season, and pleading to go down to level one. Do you think there's no sense to that argument?
I think there's sense. I understand why they're frustrated, but if that couple from Wanaka, for example, from Auckland who flew to Wanaka, had COVID, and the South Island was at level one, there would be COVID everywhere. Unfortunately, as Australia has shown with the virus seeping out of New South Wales, it's very hard to have an internal border in your country. And so as long as there is COVID rampant in one part of New Zealand, the rest of New Zealand's at risk.
Yeah, Liam, sorry.
So you'd have to have a heart of stone not to really feel for people in the South Island and, in fact, the rest of the country too. But, you know, I think the biggest risk that the government would take would be to adopt a half measure and not to see it through to the end as hard as it could. You know, if they were to drop the alert level down to alert level one, you know, that would be great for a lot of people. But as Neil says, you know, it only doesn't take much for it to become quite spread out, and that would be an absolute disaster for the government if that was to happen.
Yeah, and I think everyone wants to get back to level one, right? I think every single person in New Zealand wants to be back at level one, whatever that looks like under Delta. But the way through that is probably through some harsher restrictions in the short term.
What about support? Because again, we're hearing pleas, particularly from businesses in Tamaki Makaurau, saying this is just too hard for us this time. We're right up against it. We need more financial support. Liam, do you think the government has been too stingy in this regard?
Yeah, I do actually. I mean, I remember, I have to say, I had to eat my hat in the first time we had the big nationwide lockdown because you know, I was very sceptical that the Wellington bureaucracy would be able to get financial support out quickly enough and in sufficient volumes to really save the economy. But I gave an interview on the radio where I said just that. And, you know, at the end of my interview, people were texting in saying they'd already got their money, right? It was an astonishing feat that they pulled off. That does not seem to be happening this time. And for whatever reason, people are reporting that their payments that are coming to them are delayed, that they're not sufficient. I don't know what it is if we just don't have the financial headspace anymore, but we're not seeing a repeat of that very decisive, very quick response that we got from the government to prop up the economy last time.
I'm not sure that's necessarily the case. The wage subsidy has been going out, the business resurgence payment's been brought in and has been extended. But look, I think the government does have to keep a very close eye on this. There is you know, there's a lot of data available around the sort of the receipts coming into businesses, their financial health. And I think, as always in these situations, the government should err on the side of being generous, because we are all in this together. This is a pandemic is a social phenomenon, and we all bear costs, and we need to make sure that we're looking after each other,
yeah,
and that we don't, people don't have to unfairly wear the burden for that.
I mean, it comes down to not taking half measures again, right? I mean, if a lockdown is of a short and limited duration, and it's painful for a short and limited duration because it's for the greater good, the same logic applies to business support, right? We're not adding to the baseline of what the government's got to spend. If the government isn't doing enough, it should err on the side of being more generous. I agree with Neil. It's not a time for being penny wise and pound foolish.
The other thing I think the government needs to look at is protections for renters. There was a lot of work done last time. I'm not sure that's been replicated, and making sure that people who are vulnerable aren't put out of their houses, or who aren't eligible don't get the support they need from benefits. So I think there needs to be a bit of a focus on that area as well.
There has been an extra $10 million put into helping people access food and essential items in Auckland in response to continued need. That is very sobering when you see the images of the trucks filled with boxes of food that's desperately needed by so many people. I mean, it just, you know, that's a reminder that it just seems to be harder. It just seems to be harder all around this time, this lockdown, do you think?
Of course it is. And this is why lockdowns are not a permanent tool that we can keep going back to forever and ever. Every time we do it, it's going to be that much harder. So, you know, that when we do it, we've got to do it right? But we've also got to plan for the time that we can't switch back and forward into shutting down the economy or not. It's an unnatural thing to have the biggest city in the country effectively closed down for this long. And it just really is just going to show that, you know, we need to have the whole country vaccinated as soon as quickly. We need to have strategies in place so that we can stop using this blunt tool and use something more surgical, but we're not there yet.
I think the other thing to remember is that, you know, it is the poor who get hit hardest by lockdowns, and it is the poor who get hit hardest by COVID. You look at where the outbreaks happen, it tends to be in South Auckland among deprived communities. And you look at people who find it hardest through lockdown. You know, if you're middle class, you've got a job you can do on your computer from your home that you own, lockdown isn't as hard. I think we've got to remember that pandemics, like any crisis, highlight the inequalities that already exist in our society.
The government will be very relieved that they have been able to secure these extra 775,000 vaccines from Spain and from Denmark. I think I heard also that Spain is contributing also to Australia, who's also seeking more vaccines. How crucial was this to the government, you know, getting the vaccination rates up, but potentially not having enough to see us through this month? Liam?
Well, the optics of any sort of slowdown or rolling back of the speed would have been pretty bad for the government. I think the government does have a vulnerability on the initial pace of the vaccine rollout, and I'm pretty sure that the government was starting to feel some heat about that. That really put the foot down on accelerating vaccines after the Delta outbreak happened. And the numbers that have been coming through have been absolutely astonishing. Like I hate you to say, the government's done a good job of ramping it up quickly. If I mean, they've done it in March or April. But having ramped it up to that extent and to have those magnificent numbers, and then to have to scale it back a bit, even temporarily, would have been a real problem for the government in terms of how it looked. So the government, by securing these extra vaccines, can continue to maintain the current pace. It's good for the government, but more importantly, it's good for the country.
Neil, there's been talk about the fact that these 775,000 vaccinations should be prioritised for Auckland. And again, Michael Plank, we spoke to this morning, thought absolutely that's a no-brainer. That is where they should be focused. Do you see the government making that kind of decision?
I don't think the government sees a need for that at this stage. Obviously, the priority has to be Auckland. But with these vaccines coming through and the big shipment arriving in October from Pfizer, we should have enough as a country to vaccinate everyone who wants one. The PM mentioned yesterday in her stand-up that in addition to all of the vaccines that have been booked, there are 10,000 a day available through drive-through. And so I think if we find that people in Auckland can't get vaccines, we should look at that. But I'm pretty sure we're now at a stage where that's not necessary.
What do you think, Liam? Do you think that that prioritising the vaccinations for Auckland actually is reasonable?
To the extent that we need to do any prioritising of the vaccines, and only to that extent, we do really need to prioritise Auckland and South Auckland in particular. Auckland has been where we've had the most outbreaks of COVID, and it's where a COVID outbreak would be the most deadly, because it's where we have probably the most overcrowding in the country, where we have it's the biggest city, and it's the international gateway. So look, I hope what Neil has said is correct, and we don't need to prioritize anything in particular, because we have finally built up the capacity to be doing everywhere as fast as it could be done. But I think that can you hear me?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, sorry. I think that, to the extent that we ever have to do any prioritisation, it's just a no-brainer based on the last 18 months. We've got to get Auckland done first.
We have been hearing some frustrations from modellers and others talking about the need to bring in rapid antigen testing, for example. Michael Plank mentioned that this morning. I think we could have to agree, rather slow in bringing in the saliva testing, and we looked at that on 9 to noon last week. So do these seem to be gaps in the government's response to COVID-19, that we haven't been bringing in these other testing regimes?
I think my own view about this whole thing is that, as a rule, I think critics of the government have tended to underestimate its ability to react to events and to move quickly when things get out of hand or they look threatening. But the flip side of that is that the government hasn't really been proactive. Like when things have been plain sailing, it really does feel like we've haven't put the steps in place in an active way to be able to do things quickly or in the best possible way. And saliva testing really seems to be a case for that. So, we've got a government that can respond really well when everything sort of falls apart and they can pull it all back together. But, I mean, it's just one case of several things where I think, look, we haven't proactively managed that. We haven't brought in best practice as soon as we could. I really think that is probably what the consensus view around this government seems to be.
What do you think, Neil?
Yeah, look, I think in a pandemic that's fast moving, there are going to be things that go slowly or not as well. So I think it's important that things like saliva testing, that the foot remains on the pedal. I do think, though, there are a lot of suggestions that are brought up, such as the National Party is currently pushing on rapid antigen testing and saying it's an inexplicable failure that the government hasn't introduced this. Now, not all of the technologies that exist overseas are necessarily applicable to an elimination strategy like New Zealand has, where, for example, a rapid antigen test has a lower accuracy rate. So I just think as well, we need to be a little bit careful sometimes when people, particularly political people, come in and say there's an obvious answer, because it may well be that it's been considered and it's not quite right.
Yeah, I mean, surely this has got to be one of those situations where we take an all-of-the-above approach, right? I mean, you want to err on the side of having more options rather than less, and to develop the capacity to bring in as many different measures as you can so that you can switch and choose the correct one quickly without having to do too much work, right, in reaction to events. And that will be my criticism.
I just want to drop in here because we talked a little bit before about government support, and in fairness, we've had about half a dozen listeners now saying that they got their government payments straight away or within a couple of days, or their subsidy. So some things, our wage subsidy we got the next day. So there is some positive aspects to this.
Yeah, sure. That's great to hear. All I can go on is that the number of complaints I have had about the difficulty in dealing with things this time around has been has been much higher than the last time around. That could simply be more frustration. But, we do have for all its criticisms, we do have a pretty good public service. And it's good to hear that most people, certainly most RNZ listeners anyway, are getting their money as fast as they can.
Neil, I want to look at vaccine passports. They are, we believe, in the pipeline. How do you see these working?
If you look at overseas at what's happened, sort of usually it's a digital pass on your phone. There's a printed copy as an option, and it can be used internationally as a travel document, but also domestically.
British Columbia has already mandated that people have to present a vaccine card as a condition of entry if they're going to enter sort of higher risk venues. Our government's position has been that they're not looking to make requirements domestically for a vaccine passport. I think that's probably the right call at this stage when we're trying to just get people to voluntarily come vaccinate, but they may have to change that position if we have a longer tail of people who are finding hard to get in. But look, ultimately, I think a vaccine passport is going to become a part of daily life domestically in New Zealand because the private sector will demand it. I think consumers will demand it, and I think it'll quite quickly become a case once we're vaccinated enough that if you want to get on a plane, you want to go to a concert, you want to go to a rugby game, you're going to have to show your vaccine passport.
Yeah, it's I think the private sector will lead a lot of it. No matter what it's developed for, it'll have that secondary use. And I guess the difficulty that we're going to have is look, from a perspective of political philosophy, look, the starting point's got to be that private firms can set conditions for coming onto their premises and using their services, subject to discrimination laws. But we will see a lot of voluntary adoption on that basis. And the difficulty that we're going to have to figure out a little bit is, you know, what we do when a business that wants to use a vaccine passport as a condition of entry as a common carrier, in other words, where people don't have any other option or alternatives. And secondly, there needs to be some sort of system for verifying legitimate exemptions. You know, so people who, for example, can't be safely vaccinated, or who have a bona fide, real, genuine, conscientious objection, as to why they can't, and that's where we're going to have to do a lot of work to get the detail right. And I hope that detail has all been worked out now.
Well, that's right, Neil, isn't it? It's the policing. I mean, it's been hard enough for bus drivers, you know, with people who refuse to wear masks in public transport. So this is a big thing. And what if people want to go to a concert, but as Liam said, they have chosen not to, or they cannot be vaccinated? So it's going to have to be very carefully handled.
Definitely. And I think, as Liam said, there'll be people who can't be vaccinated. They need to be accounted for. And similarly, we could have a real issue if we find that, say, for structural reasons, Māori and Pacifica aren't as highly vaccinated as Pākehā, and it becomes a form of discrimination. So we have to make sure that we get as close to everyone vaccinated as possible across all ethnic groups if we're going to avoid some of these problems. I think as well, we can look to overseas, because one of the advantages, I guess, of some countries being ahead of us in the vaccination is that we're able to see what they've done. And if you look at, say, British Columbia, they've said, look, we're going to stop you from, say, going to a concert, but they've said you can't stop, we're not going to require you to have a vaccine passport to enter a grocery store. So those basics of life can still be accessed. If you look at what private companies are doing overseas around, say, restaurants and bars, I've seen cases where they've hired security guards, and that's an additional cost, but they've recognised that you can't put someone, say, a waitress or a bus driver in charge of turning someone away. You've actually got to have security guards, because there will be angry, aggressive people who aren't vaccinated, don't want to have a vaccine passport, and put it on that worker.
Well, I just want to share a text that's come in. It kind of illustrates the point. The day my freedom is stopped by the need for a COVID passport, I will consider myself at war. So there's going to be some pretty strong feelings here.
Yeah, and it doesn't take a lot of people like that, to be honest, to gum up the whole system. And so, I mean, one thing, look, I'm more open to compulsory vaccination or vaccine mandates in some form than most people, I have to say. But it really is, for the reasons Neil outlined, something that needs to be a last resort. One of the reasons we've been able to do what other countries haven't been able to do and to squash the virus a couple of times is our high level of social cohesion. You can have all the best rules in the world, but unless you have a population that's willing to engage with them in good faith and feel like they're part of a common enterprise, they are not going to work. You don't need a lot of people to just refuse to follow the rules before the rules break down, and you can't surveil everybody at all times. So really, the first sticks are not optimal. You know, really, we do have to do everything we can to try and get as much voluntary uptake as we can. And, you know, and for that reason, we want to have a very, very high level of vaccinations before we introduce any type of passporting system.
We've just got a few minutes before the headlines, but I thought we would address the issue of opposition leader Judith Collins having a crack at Associate Professor Dr. Susie Wiles. I'm not interested in repeating the comment that was made, but it certainly has flagged some headlines, some speculation that that her position, if not now, then sometime in the future may be at risk with this kind of comment. Liam, what do you make of it?
Well, the comment itself, like, you know, if you were to be a defence lawyer for the for Judith Collins, you would say, right, it was an idiomatic use. But, you know, even if you were to grant that, it's such a negligent thing that that itself would be an admission of guilt. I mean, look, Dr. Wiles is not popular with the National Caucus or with national voters. She's seen as somebody who's, you know, aligned in a partisan way. But the fact that Judith, you know, to the extent that that anybody thought, right, well, this news story, this beach going was an issue, was completely swamped by Judith Collins's saying that, and that's the type of thing I think that really does dent confidence. The closest analogy I can think of is that very badly received Facebook post by Simon Bridges in the first lockdown, where he was perceived to be overly negative, and it was sort of a jumping the shark moment. Now it remains to be seen if that's going to be the case for Collins, but it really doesn't help her case at all. And she'd probably be quite pleased that Auckland's in level four in some ways, because it means that her parliamentary colleagues are Auckland based can't meet to discuss it.
Neil, is this language becoming of a prime minister in waiting?
Well, no, and I think this is the problem. Last week on here, we were talking about her interview on Breakfast TV and that outburst, and I was talking about how she has uniquely terrible judgment and a lack of discipline to sort of hold herself back from her own worst instincts, and that makes her unpredictable. And the problem there is her caucus can't trust her from one day to the next not to sort of blow up over some bizarre side issue. And as someone who worked with Labour through its opposition times, I understand what that's like. You know, no one looks at Judith Collins and sees a leader capable of taking the country through a crisis. And I think when her own colleagues don't trust her, that puts her leadership on shaky ground. The problem they've got is, I think, there's no obvious alternative. The heir apparent seems to be Simon Bridges, but it was his misjudgments through COVID that lost him his leadership his first time. And so I think it's, you know, they're going to have to do some real soul searching, I think, because they're in a very hard place, and I'm not sure there's an obvious way out of it.
Thank you so much.
The Leader of the Opposition shouldn't be a pundit, right? The Leader of the Opposition should be a Prime Minister in waiting, and that requires a certain discipline not to say everything that comes into your head.
Yep. Thank you both very much. Liam here and Neil Jones, our political commentators here on 9 to Noon.